In 1988, Melvin Hett testified that of the 17 hairs, 13 were microscopically consistent with the hair of Dennis and 4 with Ron's samples. There was even a match. Also, in his third and final report, filed after Dennis's trial had started, Hett excluded Glenn Gore from any of the hair. His expert testimony was the only direct, credible proof the state offered against both Ron and Dennis, and had much to do with their convictions. DNA testing revealed that one scalp hair found under the body and one pubic hair found in the bedding had been left behind by Glenn Gore. Also, the semen recovered by a vaginal swab during the autopsy was tested. Its source was Glenn Gore. Judge Landreth knew this but had kept it confidential until the hearing. With his approval, Bill Peterson announced the Gore findings to a shocked courtroom. Peterson said, "Your Honor, this is a very trying time for the criminal justice system. This murder happened in 1982. It was tried in 1988. At that particular time, we had evidence that was presented to a jury that convicted Dennis Fritz and Ron Williamson by evidence that was, in my opinion, at that particular time, overwhelming." Without refreshing memories as to what exactly the overwhelming proof had been 11 years earlier, he rambled on about how DNA now contradicted much of what he had once believed. Based on the evidence he had left, he could not prosecute the two defendants. He asked that the motion to dismiss be granted, then sat down. At no time did Peterson offer any conciliatory comments or words of regret or admissions of errors made or even an apology. At the least, Ron and Dennis were expecting an apology. 12 years of their lives had been stolen by malfeasance, human error, and arrogance. The injustice they had endured could easily have been avoided, and the state owed them something as simple as an apology. It would never happen, and it became an open sore that never healed. Judge Landreth made a few comments about the injustice of it all, then asked Ron and Dennis to stand. He announced that all charges were thereby dismissed. They were free men, free to go. There was applause and cheering from a few of the spectators. Most, though, were not in the mood to celebrate. Annette and Renee hugged their children and relatives and had another good cry. Ron bolted from the defense table, past the jury box, out a side door, down the stairs to the front steps of the courthouse, where he paused and filled his lungs with cool air. Then he lit a cigarette, the first of a million in the free world, and waved it jubilantly at a camera. The photo was printed in dozens of newspapers. A few minutes later, he was back. He and Dennis, their families and lawyers, huddled in the courtroom and posed for photos and answered questions from a horde of reporters. Mark Barrett had called Greg Wilhoit and asked him to fly back to Oklahoma for the big day. When Ron saw Greg, they embraced like the brothers they were. "How do you feel, Mr. Williamson?" a reporter asked. "About what?" Ron shot back, then said, "I feel like my feet are killing me. These shoes are too small." The questions went on for an hour, even though a press conference was planned for later. Peggy Stillwell was helped from the courtroom by her daughters and sisters. She was overwhelmed and in shock. The family had not been warned of the news of Glenn Gore. They were back at the murder scene now, waiting for another trial, no closer to justice. And they were confused. Most of the family still believed Fritz and Williamson were guilty. But how did Gore figure in? Ron and Dennis finally began their exit, every step of it duly preserved and recorded. The mob crept down the stairs and out the front door. They paused for a second, free men now, and soaked in the sun and chilly air. They were liberated, free, exonerated, yet no one had offered an apology, an explanation, or even a dime in compensation, not a shred of aid of any type.